One interesting anecdote would be Roger Calloway's categories of play. And so the six characteristics that define the nature of play would be, number one, free. Two, separate from ordinary life, both as a playtime and a playground. Three, uncertain with unpredictable outcomes that depend on player choices. Four, unproductive, which is not governed by quote-unquote outside purposes, regulated by rules alternative to ordinary life. Fictive, so based in a transient and imagined reality separate from ordinary life for the time being. One of the greatest examples of play would be Lars von Trier's movie, The Idiots, in which these kind of white collar and sort of middle class professionals get together. You have academics, doctors, physicians, and they get together in this club and they act like retards. They act like retarded people and they call it spazzing. And so spazzing becomes so enthralling that they don't want to go back to their regular lives. They've got husbands, wives, they just want to spazz out, and they have these really funny competitions on like who's the best spazzer, like who could be like the biggest retarded person. And so that becomes the metric and how liberating it is. And this is why it's my favorite movie, because it proves the power of retardation and being an idiot, or an idioter, which translates in Greek to the private citizen. You know, somebody who is sort of an outcast, is not really a part of the social productive order. There's something intoxicating about retardation, which is, I think, explains the phenomena of the mythical real pull. Now, the mythical real pull is a nomenclature to describe the, mostly on Instagram or TikTok, the algorithm suggests various retarded people or weird creeps that could be, I don't know, the antagonist in Michael Mann's 80s thriller Manhunter or something like that. And these are people who have Down syndrome, but they're very either cheerful or playful, or they're like playing guitar, or something weird happens, or you have these Mongolian goats forming in a circle with like, you know, some kind of foreign music playing in the background, usually of his Islamic origin. And this has kind of replaced the vocation of the celebrity, because this stuff is getting massively popular. I mean, I'm seeing very strange videos constantly, and they're constantly being shown, and they're getting massive amounts of plays. Things that are getting more views than, you know, mass casualties in major world wars. This is, like, I think, massive stuff. And this is pure omni-cringe, and it is beautiful, because these are the people we should be celebrating, because we all want what they have. We don't want to be a part of society anymore. Fuck. We don't want to deal with this kind of dehumanizing exploitation. You know, there's something beautiful. Gator Bonnet is this really interesting account, and I don't know where he's based. I don't know if it's like Kuwait or, I don't really know, because I can't translate the language, but he has Down syndrome and he sings into this microphone and he tests out PA equipment and people hand him money and he goes, ha ha ha, and well, they have like this like music in the background. He's like shredding on keyboard with like, and people are hugging him and kissing him, and he's kind of like this amazing, beautiful attribute to the, you know, when you have dependency on the human, on others, it takes you out of the dependency of the marketplace. And ultimately, isn't that what we all want? We just want to be interdependent. I mean, Charles Darwin even said that might doesn't make right. You know, the dominating species throughout history have mostly gone extinct because it's about cooperation. And so cooperation is a big part of, this is where the Nietzscheans and the people on the right, they sort of get their, they get their facts mixed up, because, you know, you make yourself an insufferable motherfucker, you know, nobody's going to help you when your chips are down. So you're going to go bye-bye. And so all this shit, this like pro-bullying stuff and quote tweets and all this stuff, what's going to happen when Trump loses? What, you're gonna keep having that job? You know, Peter Thiel's going to fucking pay your rent? Nah. Because you're a fucking loser. You know, I want to see Gator Benet get up there and do his little dances and sing. And so to get off on this tangent, there are four play forms. The Aegon, the competitive games in which skill is more important. So this would be like chess or tennis. Alea, games of chance like poker. Mimicry, based on imitation and in framing of ordinary reality. So like the theater or a Comic-Con, this is a prosumer way, cosplay. And Ilix, the state of dizziness or disorder. So like riding roller coasters and spinning until you fall down, bungee jumping, skydiving, shit like that. And so Callais also suggests that the cataloging of play forms using a continuum ranging from paideia, which is free play, more spontaneous and inventive with flexible rules that might change, like festivals, jubilees, and concerts, to ludus, which is more disciplined with set rules and require specific skills within a various tradition like golf or baseball. And so the model of play, the essence of freedom and autonomy, and you cannot be forced to play. Play, the essence of intrinsic motivation. Fun, the color of joy. Play, a way to express and develop positive subjective experiences. Perma, play, a way to express and develop positive individual traits, like character strengths and values. So you're learning, you're developing your strengths, kind of like Goku would do in Dragon Ball Z, and play a way to express and develop attention, imagination, empathy, communication, and identity. Play a way to inframe other emotions as well as people, events, and allow monitoring, recognizing, and modifying controlling behavior. And so play a way to express and develop bottom-up integration skills. And so Roger Callais is sort of known for his association with Georges Bataille. And he worked mostly as a sociologist and anthropologist in literature. And he was pretty influential in the study of early game theory. Like, he had his own version of play theory that was sort of examining pre-capitalist forms of, you know, Duns Scotus, Jubilee, and mostly the nature of leisure. And so Man Playing Games is probably his most famous book. And that's where this chart of play comes in. And so he categorizes these different types of games and their significance in culture and society. And so Callais also engaged with surrealism. So he had a connection to the surrealist movement as well as the letterist movement. And so he talked a lot about aesthetics and the role in art. So he was really sort of invested in examining the interplay between modern society, modern for his time, and individual creativity. And so this is kind of where we're at right now, you know, I think. A really interesting architect, I think, is Carl Friedrich Schinkel. And I mostly for his association with Goethe, and his planning of the Weimar classicism movement, which basically emphasizes integration of art, literature, and architecture. And Goethe's engagement with architecture also extended to his personal experiences. And this was expressed through his theories of color. And this really sort of reflected his aesthetic ideals. And his thoughts on architecture sort of underscore the significance of its cultural and artistic expression, and also how it involves human play, and also an ethics as well, and certain moral standards. So the problem in applying play theory, the challenge remains to apply the new insights about the importance of adult play more efficiently. And notwithstanding the abundant evidence supporting their case, proponents like Kesley have noticed a bias against the importance of play and have felt the need to justify our play practices in clinical settings. And researchers remain reluctant as well, paying insufficient attention to play. Instead of recognizing the evidence supporting the value of play, schools have begun eliminating playgrounds and recess, preparing students exclusively for exams and jobs. And such an intrinsic results in orientating the effectively obscured value of intrinsically motivated play experiences, as well as the value of spontaneous from below creativity, exploration, and reorganization. And the devaluing of play and leisure has been going on for years. And the clinical psychologist, John Huizenga, noticed and bemoaned this fact. And you can see this even with the elementary schools in Columbus, Indiana, and the Saarinen modernist small towns of the Midwest. It was all about increasing the enjoyment of the students, their environment, so that they could do better and they could achieve more on their own, sort of, you know, liberating their will to do better rather than through some sort of disciplinary panopticon measure or something like that. And so he said, real civilization cannot exist in the absence of a certain play element, for civilization presupposes limitation and mastery of the self, the ability not to confuse the self's own tendencies with the ultimate and highest goal, but to understand that it is enclosed within certain bounds freely accepted. To get into the public policy side of things, so many of the leaders of recent attempts to provide additional free time, such as the Take Back Your Time organization, which is based out of Seattle, Washington, they only have a Facebook page. I've tried to do a bit of research into them. They haven't updated or posted anything since 2019. So I want to say, but not definitively, that this organization is defunct. But it looks cool. I mean, you know, they repost things and talk about stuff like burnout generation and all these, I think, you know, increasingly important topics that are kind of on people's minds. And so, and they had some sort of involvement with public policy. And, you know, I definitely advocate for that. And the politics of job creation and the economics of full-time, full employment entrenched in the American politics since Roosevelt's administration, it's unfortunately still supported by both major political parties. And they've really kind of prevented public policy from enabling work reductions. So with the right, and so with the turn to the right in the American politics, the dominant morality of work and wealth for themselves has been reaffirmed and now arguably more powerful than it has at any time since Germany pre-World War II. And when they say turn to the right, they mean economically. It's like, sure, social progressivism has increased, although, you know, I think sexual politics is definitely, I think we have gotten more racist, though, in recent years, which I think is pretty, it's pretty fucking stupid. But so public policy might eventually play a role in this and remove barriers that prevent people from choosing the hours they would like to work. The free marketplace, weirdly, is what Klein Honeycutt advocates for presents itself as a much more promising alternative, which is kind of interesting because you think of like the economic turn of the right, you think of state, some sort of central planning, but he actually thinks more in the Schumpeterian terms of creative destruction and liberating capitalism. He's a bit of an accelerationist in this regard. And I think, you know, real capitalism has never been tried. So maybe we should like try that out instead of trying to organize and plan around it, because both major parties do, and it hasn't really turned out that successful. Now, is it working in China? Is it working in the East? I guess so, but you know, I don't live there. I don't want to be presumptuous about that. But you know, something that I find to be pretty interesting is this idea of the arts being dead. And there have been a lot of writings on this recently where people are proclaiming that the energy has completely left contemporary art. It no longer ceases to function because it can't create anything. It can't generate its own relevance anymore. For whatever reason, you know, context collapse. I really disagree with this, though. I think Kill Tony does Boisean social sculpture kind of better than anything that's, you know, sanctioned by the quote-unquote art world. I just think, you know, discounting other forms of human expression because they don't have, you know, they're not sort of calculated by the established tastes of the critics and whatnot. I think that's really sort of wrong. And you know, Frederick Jameson, who just passed away, who has some good writing. Admittedly, I haven't read a ton of Frederick Jameson, but one of his most famous statements is that we're sort of combining things. You know, he said, "This is yet another sense in which the writers and artists of the present day will no longer be able to invent new styles and worlds. They've already been invented. Only a limited number of combinations are possible. The unique ones have already been thought of already. But art has never not been about combinations." And to reflect that, all you have to do is go back to Leibniz's early dissertation, which was his first dissertation from 1666, on the combinatorial arts. And what he tried to establish here, it's basically an extended version of his first doctoral dissertation. It was written before he had really undertaken mathematics. And so the booklet was actually reissued without his consent in 1690. And he sort of published an explanatory like addendum about it because he was pretty ashamed of it. Like he was like, this wasn't really thought out, but this is sort of the basis of his worldview and of monadology and of the best of all possible worlds, and all the Leibniz isms are contained in here. And it's just an incredibly original work, especially for somebody who wasn't necessarily mature in his systems or thought. And it also sort of gave him his foot in the door. It was a sort of like first taste of fame that people were like, whoa, this guy is a genius. And so basically, to Leibniz, all concepts are nothing but combinations of a relatively small number of simple concepts, just as words are combinations of letters. And so all truths may be expressed as an appropriate combination of concepts, which in turn can be decomposed into simple ideas, which renders the analysis much easier. And so he uses this, an example of like the alphabet of human thought. And one of the big inspirations for this was actually Lullism, Ramon Lull, and Ars Magna, and some of his categories indexing that he used. So he goes through these different classes, and he compares the system to Chinese and Egyptian languages. He didn't understand them at this point. Like, he hadn't really studied the I Ching yet. You know, Leibniz was famously into I Ching. And the preface of this, because there's a lot of kind of like mathematical stuff in here, but he prefaces with the proof of the existence of God cast in geometric form. And he bases this on the argument for motion. And one of the most interesting things actually that he wrote, I'm going to quote this now, is 53. For assuredly, the human mind is so prolific in abstraction that given any number of things, it can find a genus for them. That is, the concept shared by each of them and by nothing outside them. In fact, even if the mind does not find it, God will know it, and the angels will find it, so that the basis of all the mind's abstractions is pre-existent. So if the basis of all of mind's abstractions are pre-existent, as in God has the ultimate domain over originary creation, like human beings, we don't have absolute a perception. We can only create things out of the things that God has created in as a pre-existing dimension to our beings or existences. So how can we quote-unquote create an original art that's not combinatory if we had no role in creating it to begin with, and everything is essentially synthesis? You know, we live in a world of synthesis. This is how concepts become born. They're synthesized, indexed, categorized, and we turn them into systems. And so all we're doing is systemically organizing these concepts and arranging them already. So Frederick Jameson's argument, this argument by these kind of like critics, just because they have nothing to write about, because they're still beholden. You know, it's the same thing with podcasting. Like, a lot of people are thinking of things to talk about right now because there's not, you know, language has exhausted itself, but it hasn't, because history goes on. And it's really up to the clown to, it's become more difficult and difficult to recognize clowns in their morphological sense right now. And like, what is a clown? Is it some political polemicist? No, that's exhausted itself. It's no longer interesting, you know? And so this arrangement of jesters and clowns has changed. And just because it's changed and the plane and the scope of things has changed doesn't mean that it ceases to exist, you know, regardless of if it's a method or not. You know, so to me, it's like, well, where is human expression? Where is this really being channeled? I really recommend the new MJ Lenderman album. I think it's really fantastic stuff, not just as a, you know, Southern rock guitar fan, but I think the lyrics are great. It's got a David Berman, Silver Jews kind of poetry, like slack-jawed poetry quality with some good guitar, nice, tasty guitar solos. I'm just like, man, this is good stuff. This is the stuff that people gotta like celebrate. You know, this in absurdist, you know, slapstick shit. And it's like, this is bringing you into the experience. This doesn't, you know, even like the art, the gallery system. One of the things I've read is that some of these galleries are sort of they're closing and taking more like advisory roles. And that's, I just think this is the way shit's going, and it's fine. You know, you just kind of got to go with the roll with the punches, you know? That's what Contain is all about. Like, I'm not really precious about the medium or anything, But I do think, you know, butt rock is a pretty interesting medium to explore, especially as I think, you know, the midlife crisis, the failed poet, the failed rocker. There's something really to that. There's something sincere about the guy who, you know, fucked his back up carrying Marshall half stacks and sleeping on the floors for a decade just to find himself priced out of an expensive city he was once in. You know, there's something like romantic and beautiful about that. You know, I think the failure is going to be celebrated more. You know, it's like this William, this one guy on Kill Tony, he's like, well, there's a bunch of freaks on there, but they're William Montgomery is just this total weirdo, like nut job. And he's like selling out, you know, people just want to see some like whack job, like doesn't really know what he's doing. You know, that's like the new thing. I think that's relatable. You know, we don't know what we're doing. I get so weirded out by like people who assert that they know, but they're only in the world of language production. They don't actually make anything. It's like, it's so cynical. Like I don't really have a lot of respect for like the medium of podcasting. I really don't. I mean, I have to be honest about this. Like, I just don't respect it. Like, I do it. I try to do other shit too. I think it's, you know, I think podcasters should try to do other things that they understand what they're doing better, or they should listen to other people. So much of this is not talking. It's very difficult to talk for me, because I think you have to be like really ultra narcissistic in order to just be, you know, to think that everybody who disagrees with you is wrong, or that you have all the information that you can say at any given point and not completely exhaust the point that you're trying to make. I just think it's terrible for that. That's why we got to make power ballads, man. That's why we got to bring this thing back. But I do think, you know, there's gonna be kind of people trudging along and trying to figure this thing out. And as long as you can get right size and be like, hey, I'm just a small part of this, man. You know, I don't control the discourse or the art or whatever, you know, like I'm just trying to create, just, you know, this is just riffing on ideas so that we can do them, you know. And the more you riff on it, you know, it's like, I see this as kind of like a way of building out a system for the music or the whatever that we're trying to do. I don't think it would exist without this, and it's not like getting a ton of listens or anything, but I think it's a part of a larger, broader system. And so hopefully we can figure this thing out, at least so people can like get by doing what they love to do and not, you know, feel like they're enslaved and chained down to these lifestyleisms. Because another issue with the arts is that, you know, Lee Lozano, who we did almost an entire episode on, she dropped out, and that was her legacy, you know, dropping out of these worlds. But now people become artists so that they get endless access to celebrity. And it's like, you don't, the reason art, contemporary art, is dying is because people want to live rent-free in people's heads. Like, I don't want to live rent-free in anybody's head. Like, I just want to go away. I don't want anybody to fucking think about me. Like, I just don't want that, man. You know, that's really, that is taking away, giving away your power, you know, giving away, it takes something away from, it colonizes your spirit as well. So that's sort of my riff that I've been thinking about in terms of this whole, are the arts dead? You know, Spike just had a whole issue basically on it. And, you know, they're only looking at things from this extremely limited scope of like what the market decides. But like, what if galleries just started having things like you know, cutting hair or doing, you know, events or doing things that were more sort of interactive that weren't just based on selling the art? What if no art is even sold? What if you just charge admission to do events here, you know, or it becomes sort of like a museum model? Boris Groys has some good ideas about the museum and its function as a part of a public space that he says that, like, galleries, he's not like that hot on art galleries, but he's always talking about the museum, you know, and the archive and all of these other, you know, not to get too much into a side rant here, but I think that's pretty interesting. I think that's a cool, you know, sort of embracing humiliation and degradation a bit. We have to do that. You know, we can't, cool is too subjective. And also it's like, who fucking cares what's cool? Like, I don't fucking care. Like, what even is embarrassment? What is cool? You know? It's okay to be a clown. It's okay to laugh at you. And so this is kind of what gives way to the cognitive cultural economy, or as it's known, cognitive cultural capitalism. And so this is represented by high-tech industry, business, financial services, personal services, media, and cultural industries. Cultural industries being a kind of operative here. And you sort of see how these venture capitalists and technologists sort of graft onto culture. And this isn't a novel phenomenon. So if you look at something like Urbit and these kind of like culture vulture type, you know, Ponzi, weird, I don't know, you could say suspiciously functioning things that basically don't really work that well. This isn't really anything new. I mean, this had been taking place in Expo 70 was probably the best example of this, the World Fair in Osaka, which I covered extensively in other episodes, how artists become sort of like the first people that these systems, they get means tested on. And so art is a really kind of tricky thing, you know. Any sort of way of culture making has become less about the folk or rooted content and more about how it grafts on and maps onto these systems at large. And so the cognitive cultural economy is really associated with post-Fordism. It's also known as the knowledge economy or even the new economy. And so the Fordist mass production began to wane. And by the late 70s, advanced capitalist countries started to deindustrialize because they could essentially take capital and use it with data. And so data and data mining and data harvesting became a massive industry on its own. Now, this is more modular. It's a lot easier to extract money from because the oversight, the overhead is a lot lower, which is kind of interesting because in the homebrew economics book, it sort of talks about like low overhead micro businesses. And I think if you're going to compete with these large things and also evade capture, you have to kind of think like these corporations did towards the end of the 1970s. And a lot of this was a kind of developed response to the insufficiencies of the transition of post-Fordism to post-Fordism and towards a model of flexible accumulation. That's a really interesting term, flexible accumulation. And so these early studies of this new system, they were starting to be published in the 80s based on case materials focused on industrial technology districts in the U.S., like Silicon Valley, obvious with Apple, IBM was another one, Boston's Route 128. And so they basically revived craft industries. And so, and basically over the following decades, a lot of empirical and theoretical advances were made on this basis of studies of this quote unquote new cultural economy. Another one that we've seen is global coffee house aesthetics with like Cocapellis and Ruins and this kind of Java world coffee shop kind of neo-tribal aesthetic that you started.